Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast you're listening to right now. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. People call me Whitney Seibold.
Yes. Yes, no, they do.
Yeah, nothing to gossip about. Just straightforward. Yeah. Just address me. All right. I will respond.
Cool. And yet you always make a big deal out of it. You could just say your name and then we could move on.
I know.
Instead, you try to make a point about how...
I have to match your rhythm. You introduce yourself and you give your nickname. And I can... If I just say my name, it just like falls flat.
And it stops the podcast dead every time you do it.
It's like a...
If he's really worried about the rhythm, please stop it.
Splopping down. It's like a pantyhose filled with pasta just landing on the ground there.
So are we talking... I'm just going to not ask about that. we're reviewing movies this week on Critically Acclaimed, reviewing the new releases Army of the Dead, Seance, Final Account, and Drunk Bus. And over on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, the part of the podcast where our listeners over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork all vote for a older film that at least one of us, Whitney Seibold and or myself, have not seen that is currently available on a streaming service. For us to watch, because we're watching most of our stuff on streaming services anyway. And why ignore all the great catalog titles just because new stuff comes out? Yeah. So we want to make sure they're always in the process of exploring the history of cinema and sort of filling in the gaps in all of our respective collections. And this week, we are talking about a film that is often hailed as one of the best films ever made. It is Guillo Pontecorvo's really controversial film... The Battle of Algiers.
That's Guillo Pontecorvo.
Is it Guillo?
Guillo, yeah.
Okay.
He's an Italian filmmaker.
Okay. Weird that I mispronounced that.
That's fine.
Anyway.
We live in Southern California. Whenever we see a double L, we pronounce it as if it were Spanish.
I suppose that's true. Yeah. But in any case, Guillo Pontecorvo's The Battle of Algiers, which is currently available on HBO Max and the Criterion Collection. And, we'll talk about that at the end of the episode. Before we get into any of that, hello, how are you? You doing okay? I just want you to know that we're thinking about you. You know, we hope you're having a good day. Hope if you're listening to this on your commute, hands at 10 and 2. Make sure you're checking your blind spots, safety first. If you're listening to this at home, take a load off. Yeah. Pour yourself a drink. I don't know.
How long can you keep this up, I wonder? This little snippets of small talk you're flinging out there.
I don't know. I was like, people like, how's it going? Chris. Hi, Chris. Just want you to know. I know quite a few Chris's who listen to the show. Good to hear from you. Anyway, let's review some movies.
Let's talk about Army of the Dead, shall
we? Let's talk about Army of the Dead, the second really long... pulpy genre film from Zack Snyder this year. Zack Snyder, of course, director of such films as Dawn of the Dead, the remake, 300, The Watchmen, Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, and the most recent version of Justice League. He basically he wants to like erase the theatrical cut from his filmography, although, and focus on his much longer director's cut.
Zack Snyder does have sole directorial credit on the theatrical cut of Justice League.
However, we've seen both versions, and it's very clear that Joss Whedon reshot a lot of that shit.
He reshot a lot of it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to Alan Smithy that film. I think both of them would probably be happier if we did.
Maybe so, but as I said when we reviewed the longer version of Justice League, I feel about them the same. I'm equally entertained by both versions.
There's a couple of things in the theatrical cut I thought were good, but mostly, I gotta admit, I think Zack Snyder's cut is better. I still think it's bloated. I think you can lose at least 45 minutes out of the first half, and you'd never know they were gone.
Technically, in terms of like structure and clarity and character... Yes, it is technically the better movie, but it doesn't make it a more entertaining film.
Here's what it is for me, and I think this is actually relevant to Army of the Dead, so I want to revisit this for a second.
Okay.
Zack Snyder's career has mostly been spent making really expensive spectacle films. Even the films of his that are considered small, like Dawn of the Dead is like a lower budgeted horror movie. Like it's a studio film, so it was pretty expensive overall, but compared to his other films... relatively inexpensive. But the majority of his stuff has been really big, ambitious spectacle movies. But I feel like there's two kinds of movies that he's made. He's made movies that are pretty straightforward pulp, and then he's made movies that have a lot of thematic ambition. And I feel that when he is going for straightforward pulp, he's a genuinely good filmmaker. I think he's got a great eye. I think he's got a wonderful sense of... he appreciates broad storytelling, and he doesn't shy away from it. And some of his best films embrace that and make it fun. When he tries to tell a big epic story with a lot of resonant themes and complexity, I think he whiffs it. Pretty consistently.
I think he whiffs it because the kinds of ideas that Zack Snyder seems to be interested in as a filmmaker are very simple and kind of dark ideas.
Well, he's a deconstructionist. He likes to tear things down.
But, you look at something like Justice League, all of his sort of Randian ideas come to the fore, and that's also something that comes to the fore in 300, which is a film that just outwardly celebrates fascism.
Yes, point of the movie is it's being told by a fascist propagandist. He's trying to drum up excitement for a war effort, and that's why the story is so simple. Unfortunately, it's indistinguishable from actual fascist propaganda, which is a problem. And I think the movie isn't aware of that.
Compare it to something like Starship Troopers, which is a send up of fascist propaganda.
And it's constantly winking at us. It's you have to be willfully obtuse to miss it.
And I don't want to get into the weird sexual politics of something like Sucker Punch, which is completely it's
a misfire.
Misguided in a lot of ways.
It's a misfire.
Here he is doing what is more or less it's a heist movie. It's Escape from New York
with zombies.
It meets Aliens, meets
Ocean's 11. Beats zombies. And you know what? That's and I think Justice League, his version of Justice League, was also, like, he kind of stripped away a lot of the whole, like, we're going to talk about what it means to really be a god, and what if God was real? Wouldn't we have to kill him? He stripped that all away, and he told a relatively straightforward, epic, but relatively straightforward superhero story, and I think that's why that Justice League movie mostly works. Here, he is taking a variety of pulpy, like, one step above the Asylum level of, like, high concept. Okay, we're going to do Escape from New York, but it's in Vegas, and instead of a whole bunch of, like, incarcerated criminals, they're zombies. Cool.
All right.
That sounds cool. Let's do that. And he really, aside from a couple of very strange elements, which seem to be setting things up for sequels that I have no interest in seeing, it's a straightforward, bloated, but a straightforward zombie heist spectacular set in Vegas that takes a lot of advantage of that locale. And you know what? It's stupid, and I had fun.
I agree that it's stupid, and I didn't have fun.
That's a shame.
I think because Zack Snyder isn't a very fun filmmaker. Even when he's doing pulp material, I don't think he knows how to have fun. I think he's got, he knows how to joke around a little bit. He has a bit of a sense of humor.
Right.
He knows how to employ funny actors to passable effect.
A lot of the cast in this is quite good, yeah.
I think Tig Notaro is the best part of this. Mm-hmm. Tig Notaro plays the helicopter pilot. And indeed, the cast is pretty much just off-the-rack stock characters. Yeah. There's the leader guy and the tough guy and the safecracker character. They're all sort of assembled by a millionaire to break into Las Vegas to steal a bunch of money. Las Vegas has been walled off because the zombie outbreak happened there.
Yeah, so it's been quarantined for quite a few years now, and the United States government is finally at the point where it's like, fuck it, let's just nuke it.
Yeah,
we're going to nuke it, we're going to get rid of the zombie contamination for forever. It's going to get nuked on 4th of July, and so we only have a couple of days left, but in a vault at the bottom of one of the casinos is $250 million in cash. So a millionaire comes to them and says, hey, this is probably you're probably going to die, but if you don't, you're going to get a shit ton of money. We want you to steal all this money.
Yeah.
And so they assemble a team of people who have nothing better to do, nothing else to live for. I love it when they ask Tig Notaro. It's like, hey, Tig Notaro, would you like, we need a helicopter. We need someone for our team, and we'll spend $5 million. He's like, great, I'm in. Do you want to know what it is? Nope. I hate my life, and $5 million will fix it. I will do whatever you want me to do. Do you want to have any details? I assume something with the helicopter? Yeah, I'm in.
Would it come to me otherwise?
Yeah.
And, But this idea of a bunch of sort of marine meatheads breaking into zombie Las Vegas seems like it would present a lot of fun opportunities. And indeed, there's some imagery in here that would make for fun stuff. Think of something like Mars Attacks, which is just wild and kitschy. There's a zombie Elvis impersonator. There's a bit with zombie Liberace and zombie showgirls attacking a guy. One of Siegfried and Roy's tigers is now a zombie, and it's wandering around eating people. Why isn't that fun? Why aren't those things fun? Why am I looking at those things and just sort of watching other zombies?
A lot of them are incidental. They're not really, like, focused on. The only thing that gets
They don't have to be focused on. They just need to be employed in a creative kind of way.
And if they, if you didn't focus on them long enough to employ them for, in a creative way, they're not going to make any impact. They're just going to be there. That's my point. The only one of those things you mentioned that gets more than, like, a shot or two is the zombie tiger. His name's Valentine. And there's actually one great bit where it does get to kill someone, and you can tell that, like, they actually paid attention to a cat playing with a toy, because it, like, they the person's trying to fight back, and they're like, you made it into a game. You made it into a game now. Knocking him into a car. And that whole bit was fun. I got to have a good time.
The gore is pretty spectacular. Yeah. I do like the way the blood sprays in this movie. There is a fun bit where they have to break into a safe, but there's booby traps.
Yeah.
So they just, like, go up an elevator into the casino where all the zombies are hanging out. Just grab one, bring it down, and push it down, like, the alleyway where all of the booby traps are, so it gets crushed instead of them.
Yeah.
That's kind of a cute bit.
That's genuinely funny.
It needs a lot more snap. This movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes long. It needs to
way
be
too long.
80?
I'm okay with it being an hour and 40. I think there's a lot. There's enough action
with
credits. There's enough action here. I feel like you can make this an hour and 45, maybe. But like 2 hours and 15 minutes is pushing it, especially considering a lot of it feels like padding. Like, there's this whole thing with this character played by Theo Rossi. Theo Rossi, you might remember from the Daredevil series. He's a really good actor, actually. And he plays this enormous creep who works as a security guard at a sort of a refugee camp for people who are displaced after the zombies took over Vegas. And it's very topical.
Yeah, and he's victimizing the people inside.
He's a horrible human being. And there's a bit where they have to bring him into Vegas for reasons we don't understand. And then we do. And then it really does seem like they're building this character. They're setting him up for something later. Mm. And no. Like, he comes back, but, like, they don't actually, like, it's kind of, like, not worth bringing up again. Like, it's sort of thing where it's, like, we're setting up something for, like, a big dramatic heft, and it never actually comes. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of things where, like, for example, there's a weird thing in this movie. Every once in a while, and they never talk about it, when they shoot a zombie in the head, what you gotta do to kill him? You shoot him in the head. Every once in a while, they shoot a zombie in the head, and we see underneath their skin, they were a robot.
Wait, I think I missed that.
Oh, yeah. All of a sudden, like, the skull underneath them is shiny reflective silver, and, like, instead of, like, bleeding, there's, like, an electric spark. They never talk about that.
That's a little bizarre.
It's super weird, and it makes me think this is, like, some sort of sequel thing that we would get to at some time.
Oh, God.
I don't want that sequel. Yeah. That's putting a hat on a hat. I don't care about any of that. There's a lot of that. We don't need any of that shit. Its simplicity is actually where this lies, because this is a heist movie where the complication is you're going through zombies. That's it. That's all we need. We don't need any more than that. I think what you're talking about in terms of, like, where, like, the fun is missing, I feel like Zack Snyder has a sense of what's sort of entertaining to put on camera, but I don't feel like as a filmmaker he has a sense of whimsy.
No.
That's what I think is missing from this, and I think it's missing.
Well, I use the word kitsch, and that's something he doesn't grasp.
It's not him at all, and I think you look at his superhero movies and you realize that he doesn't have, like, I don't know if he has a self-aware bone in his body. I really don't. I think that's what a lot of people like about his stuff, is that it's very sincere.
It's a little too earnest for
the
his own
Great
good.
Pumpkin would visit Zack Snyder. I think we can all agree on this, right? Very sincere. But sometimes the material that he's got begs for a little bit more camp showmanship. And all of that's gone here. I think the cast and the script are sometimes able to elevate the material and make it a little bit more funny than it probably would be otherwise. But yeah, this is just completely committed to the bit. And after the opening credits, where there's a lot of like sort of bizarre set pieces in a row, like a big montage, there's not a lot of humor in this at all.
There's during that montage, actually, that's a good thing to bring up, because that montage shows a lot of the things I was talking about. You know, the zombie showgirls and zombie outbreak in Vegas. Okay, fun. Let's have a little bit of fun. Las Vegas is a big, glitzy, clunky, kitschy kind of place. Let's
full of iconography we're aware of.
Well, iconography plus you just sort of that... It's the place where the party goes to get pathetic. It's like your last gasp of whatever it is you're trying to achieve. That happens in Vegas.
Yeah, stop it on the table.
Sorry. And during that montage where we get to see Vegas fall to the zombie hordes, we get to see like some civilians fighting back in this really violent fashion. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be a quick shot of them like they're in a... enlist in the Marines ad holding up a portrait of the person they used to be and the person they are now. And this is another case of Zack Snyder celebrating the people who are really proficient at doing military violence. And that is the exact opposite of kitsch and whimsy, isn't it? It's trying to sell this idea that we're here for the military violence and not to have fun.
And I feel like what I feel like the tone he's trying to strike here is something more akin to something like James Cameron's Aliens, which is really tough and is full of broad characters. But ideally, and I know you're not as big a fan of this movie as I am, or a lot of people, but
another movie that could use a little kitsch sense of humor, maybe.
Well, I think it's funnier than you're giving it credit, and that's kind of my point. But it's another one where it's very celebratory of its characters. It's also very critical of its characters. The whole point is, here's this army of space marines, and we're supposed to think that, like, sorry, colonial marines. And they're talking themselves up, and we think to themselves, oh, great, these aliens are going to get their butts kicked. This is going to be a short movie. And then they almost all immediately die, and the ones who have the most bravado are, like, reduced to quivering cowards because they were not prepared for this level of evil. So there's a level of sort of irony to something like Aliens and the way it presented that level of warfare, and that isn't here, because these characters don't have that moment of realization. They don't have that moment where they change. They're just... And I think
Zack Snyder... They're meatheads at the start, and they're meatheads at the end.
And some of them have thoughts and cares, and I actually like them as characters. They're not complicated, but I like them fine. I want to follow their journey. There's a couple of people when they died, I was like, ah, I like that one. Like, you know, that kind of thing. They were cool. That stinks. They were neat. Okay. So, like, that's enough for me for here. Because I feel like as bloated and gigantic and as expensive as this movie clearly was, this is not like a cheapo zombie movie. They put a lot of money and time into this. I got the same level of thrill as I did out of, like, George Romero's Land of the Dead. Right, which had more interesting thoughts to explore.
It was actually about something a little bit more than this one.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's the thing that mostly I find frustrating about this movie, is that it seems like a lot of effort went in to something that you could have spent $30 million with the same script and given me the same entertainment value. And maybe you could have rewritten the script a few times, because, man, there's some shit in this script. I'm giving you so much slack on this script, because there's zombies in Vegas, and there's a heist, and there's going to be a nuclear bomb, and I'm like, great, I'm suspending so much disbelief. And this movie still finds a way to strain credulity even after all of that goodwill has been expended. For example, $250 million, that's how much they're trying to steal in cash.
It's a big, heavy bundle that they have to lift out in a helicopter.
Yeah. You ever actually think about how much that weighs?
An awful lot. Enough that they need a helicopter to lift it.
They need a helicopter to lift it. But here's the thing. $250 million is the exact same amount of money that was being stolen in J.C. Chandor's movie Triple Frontier. Did you see that with Ben Affleck and Oscar Isaac?
No.
The plot of the movie...
Oh, wait. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did see
it's a somewhat Frontier. Forgettable film, but the central plot of it is Ben Affleck and Oscar Isaac and a couple other, you know, tough guy actors.
It's Kelly's Heroes, where
kind of
war film where they're stealing money.
I mean, they're not in the middle of a war like Kelly's Heroes. They're vets who come back, basically.
Yeah.
And they're hired to kill like a big like South American drug boss, and but they decide they're also going to steal all the money, because why not? But it's like $250 million. Like, that's the amount, and that weighs. And I actually, it's not hard to figure out how much that weighs, because a dollar bill is an exact amount. It's 1 gram. $250 million weighs almost 3 tons. That's a lot.
Well,
and the plot of Triple Frontier is that they have this.
Are you counting $1 bills or are you counting $100 bills?
I'm counting $100 bills. All right. In $100 bills, that's nearly 3 tons.
Maybe they're $1 million bills.
There's no such thing. And again, it's Vegas, and the odds of all of the denominations being the same in a safe in Vegas is pretty thin.
Yeah.
So, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say it's 3 tons. 3 tons. In the plot of Triple Frontier, they have a giant military helicopter, like a really big one.
That can lift 6,000
pounds. Not the kind of thing that could land on like a rooftop, like a big military-grade helicopter. And the plot of the movie is, with like 4 people in that helicopter and 2.75 tons of money, that helicopter becomes incredibly sluggish and difficult to take off and like let alone maneuver.
Yeah.
So the plot of this movie is we're going to steal 2.75 tons and we're going to have a civilian or like very small military grade helicopter to take it off.
That's breaking down. Yeah. It's like been on a roof for a long time.
Yeah. And none of these people who are supposedly professionals, trained military professionals, people who think about things like, you know, logistics, at no point in the movie do they say, doesn't that weigh a shit ton? Isn't that a logistical problem? Like, how are we going to get all of that money on the roof, let alone on a helicopter? And is the helicopter big enough to actually handle all that weight and us in it? At no point do they think about that. And that's not the biggest deal in the world. I'm not saying that ruins the movie, but
It's just a sign that they're not thinking about certain details.
It's such an obvious question that you would ask in regarding, you know, because a lot of any heist movie is the planning, the setup. It's such an obvious question to ask that I was just distracted that nobody asked it. It's so obvious. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not saying I'm not pretending I'm like, you know, the genius or whatever like that, but I was distracted by just this really obvious detail. Also, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about how this comes together, but apparently in the world of Army of the Dead, atomic bombs have no nuclear fallout.
And you can also fly away from it in a helicopter.
Yeah, that doesn't like create an EMP or anything. Or...
No, nothing at all.
Yeah, you're not gonna grow like another nose or anything. It's not gonna burn your flesh.
This is the version of a nuclear bomb that the United States thought they were dealing with before they were dropping them.
Yeah,
you'd watch like duck and cover videos in schools. They thought it was just like more TNT.
But it raises the question, like, if you're not going to make a big deal out of things that we all know about atomic bombs, if you're not a little kid, you know at least enough about atomic bombs to know that there is a lot of radiation afterwards, and things like prevailing winds would be a major factor. Especially considering that people are still living really close to Vegas. Like, it's not like it's been quarantined for, like, 100 miles in either direction. Like, people are still... It's still a populated state. If that's going to be the issue, why don't you just say you're not using nuclear bombs? Just use other bombs. You're just blowing up one city. Just use a lot of bombs.
It's just one city.
Well, my point is this. Why do you want that so much of America to be irradiated? Just blow it up with, like, a whole bunch of, like, big-ass bombs. We have a bunch of bombs.
We have bombs out everywhere. This is a premise, and a lot of the details are taken from films of the 1980s. It is kind of a throwback film.
True.
But unfortunately, it's in the hands of Zack Snyder, who doesn't really know how to make it punchy like some of those 80s, like cheapy 80s actioners.
He doesn't know how to playfully call his shots and just say, haha, we're just having fun. Like, he takes it dead seriously a lot of the time.
There's an entire subplot about how the zombies have been evolving and they have a king and they do battle with the zombie king and queen, and it's
mostly doesn't go anywhere.
Kind of useless. Yeah, it doesn't add to the plot.
It's a neat idea. I've seen it done a couple of times, but like, this has been a good opportunity to explore it. Doesn't really go anywhere.
No. So they could have cut all of that stuff out. And the soundtrack. Oh god, the soundtrack. Oh, we have to talk about it because it is an issue.
Okay.
Zack Snyder rather famously has really shitty taste in pop music. And god,
his music choices are, if nothing else, I think we can all agree on this, really on the nose.
A little on the nose.
He's not subtle. He's not clever. He's pretty much. There's a song choice in the Zack Snyder version of Justice League. Like, there's a bit where Aquaman realizes that some bad shit's going down. He's about to go into Atlantis. And in the theatrical cut, it's the White Stripes. And it's insufferable. It's just like, yeah, I'm fucking awesome, and I'm going to throw down this glass bottle of whiskey, and I'm going to jump in the ocean, and yeah. In the Zack Snyder version, they changed them to the song. And I don't remember the exact song or the lyrics, but I'm going to give you the gist of it. It sounds like Leonard Cohen going something like, I'm a king, I'm a king, I'm a really sad king. And I'm like, oh my God, how could you find a worse needle drop than that? Yeah, I was like, well, I literally was watching them back to back just so I could get a really good sense of all the things that changed. Yeah. And I was watching Justice League Theatrical the first time, and I'm like, this is a terrible needle drop. I'll bet this changes. And then the second time watching it, I watched the Snyder version, I'm like, how did you make it sillier? How did you do that? It's incredible.
Yeah, there's like bummer covers of pop songs that are completely like don't match the scene at all.
Yeah.
And yes, rather famously, they use the Cranberries zombie.
Yep.
Non-diegetically, like it's on the soundtrack.
It's just thematic.
Like it's not sort of like a jokey thing where a character's listening to it. Like it's just on the soundtrack. After all the shit's gone down, and they start playing zombie. It's like, come on. Come on, man.
Well, it's also a song.
I need some creativity.
Like purely on the surface, it's so obvious. It's laughable.
Well, also the song Zombie isn't about zombies.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's exactly the case. It's actually about like tragedy and people dying because of like the IRA and the British fighting over Northern Ireland and like it's actually like and it this isn't that long ago. The
Cranberries would be so mad.
Well,
that Zack Snyder put this in there.
One has to wonder if some of them signed off on it or not.
Well, yeah.
I mean, Dolores O'Riordan sadly is no longer with us.
Right.
In the 90s, I don't know if people really appreciate how big the Cranberries were for a couple of years in the 90s. They were a huge band.
Between Zombie and Linger, I think, were their biggest hits. But they're pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah, they were great. I actually love the Cranberries, and they were a very political band, and this was considered a protest song.
Yeah,
and so warping this protest song, it would be like if imagine if this is what it's like. I'm going to try to give you like sort of a general sort of comparison here. Remember that movie Hurricane Heist, where there was a hurricane in the middle of the hurricane, they pulled a heist.
I didn't see it, but it sounds.
Imagine if. The whole movie Hurricane Heist ended, and over the credits, they played Bob Dylan's Hurricane. Hmm. You'd be like, did you listen to the lyrics of that, or did you just look at the title of the song and go with it? Because that is not appropriate in any way. It's a really weird choice.
It was Bad Moon Rising.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That they did the bummer remix for. Yeah. It's not a bummer remix, it's a cover, but it's a bummer cover.
It's like an a cappella, quiet, moody cover of Bad Moon Rising, and it's weird because it's like this montage where they're getting ready to like go into battle and stuff, and like this is like the gearing up sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the scene in The Italian Job where Michael Caine's like, you're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. Like that kind of prep. Getting ready for the big action.
But this plaintive coffee house vocal, I see a bad moon rise.
It doesn't really contribute to the scene
and for a second, I could have sworn Zack Snyder confused zombies and werewolves. It was just, no. You wanted to use this in a werewolf movie, but you haven't made one yet, so you just threw it in here.
Because when they use that song, because that song's in American Werewolf in London, right? I'm not crazy. It's in there, right?
I think it is. But again, American Werewolf in London is like a comedic tone.
Yeah. It's a comedy. And like this is a movie that has some jokes in it. Let's not pretend otherwise. But I hesitate to call it a comedy. It's definitely not like a comedy horror movie because the tone isn't quite light enough. But like in American Werewolf in London, all of the songs in the soundtrack have the word moon in the title, whether they're thematically appropriate or not. And that gives you the freedom.
Because
it's a joke.
And that makes every needle drop, a little bit of a wink. It's a running gag.
Every needle drop is a dad pun.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. That's the whole... Then that you get a lot of freedom out of that.
Meanwhile, Zack Snyder is just a dad iPod.
Yeah. I will say this. So just to close it off here. It's a big, stupid movie. At no point does the movie claim that it's smart. Oh. I'm going to give it some credit for this. I think they knew it was a big, stupid concept. And I think Zack Snyder, again, I think when you give him something straightforward, he will make something... that like looks good and has a lot of cool action in it. And I actually like, some people have been making fun of, he uses extensive shallow focus in this movie, like extensively. Yeah. I actually think it looks fine. I think it looks fine. I think it's an interesting aesthetic. It's a different aesthetic than he's used to. I'm okay with it. I just want to mention it because so many people have been talking about it. I think it looks okay. I didn't have a problem with it. But, like, I think that this is as a straightforward, longer than it needed to be, more expensive than it needed to be. But otherwise, we're doing a zombie heist film. I had a good time. I don't love it. Right. I don't love it, but I had an entertaining time. I wasn't bored. It lost me towards the end when the stupid started piling up en masse, and like it was just, it just really wrecked any level of plausibility I was even having within the movie's own internal logic. Mm. But still wasn't so bad that it ruined the movie for me. It just made it less of a sort of like a yay recommendation and more of a, it's on Netflix. It's on Netflix. Might as well watch it.
Turned into somebody's Brooklyn grandfather there for a second. Hey, it's on Netflix.
Yeah, you mean you might as well. Yeah, it's like, you know, you're in the bathroom. There's a magazine there. I don't normally read Town and Country, but I might as well. I'm there.
If you're in front of Netflix, but I can't find my shoes. If you're so I'm stuck on the couch,
if you're in front of Netflix. There are worse things to click on than Army of the Dead, and that is my recommendation.
Your recommendation. If you're being held prisoner, it's fine.
I had an entertaining time, but it's not without reservation.
Yeah, I think it's a too big version of a too cliched movie.
Yeah. I really want to see, because they did, this is the kind of movie where I want to see the Asylum mockbuster, because I suspect if you got,
it would
like,
actually probably be better.
It would be as good or better. There is an Asylum movie that opened this week, and I'm bummed that I couldn't see it. Because, unfortunately, my like debit card number got stolen, so I have no access to any money, so I couldn't like pay to watch it on VOD. But I really wanted to see Aquarium of the Dead, starring Vivica Fox, and the whole thing is, it's SeaWorld, but all of the fish are undead monsters, and like a bunch of like really crappy low-rent CGI octopi and like dolphins and shit are like attacking people. Yes. And I'm watching this trailer. Look at the trailer. It's really, it's charmingly stupid. I'm looking at this trailer for Aquarium of the Dead, and I'm thinking to myself, I will probably end up getting about as much entertainment value out of something like Aquarium for the Dead. Maybe not specifically that one, but something of its ilk. Mm. As I would out of Army of the Dead. Which is to say, perfectly entertaining, watchable thing to do, but maybe we don't need to spend as much money on this.
No.
Maybe we can do this more. Maybe we don't need to spend
that
much.
There are many, many movies that benefit from a smaller budget.
Yeah.
And most of the ones that have a budget of over $200 million, I feel would be a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
If they were made for $30 million.
Yeah.
If, like, the filmmakers had to get a little bit more creative.
What's the budget on this? The budget on this was $70 to $90 million.
Okay.
Which, to be fair, is still a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot for a film like this, anyway. Mm-hmm.
Hold on, I want to actually look at something. I want to compare this to something. Hang on.
Versus I know it was, I think it was $70 million that Warner Brothers spent to remake Justice League.
Okay, I'm gonna say this right now. Okay, so the budget for Army of the Dead, according to Wikipedia, so it's going to be a little, and it's also, they don't really like go into elaborate detail when they provide budgets for these things anyway, because they don't want everyone crunching the numbers at home, but estimated budget, $70 to $90 million. This has a big cast, this has a ton of CGI, this has big epic action sequences, and so you see where the money went. Mm. Cost $70 to $90 million. I want to give you a name of a film that cost $79 million.
Jack and Jill.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what you were going to do.
Exactly my point.
Jack and Jill had like an $80 million budget, and it, clearly it went to cast.
Yeah.
Like, they just gave, like, just overpaid all the actors.
We had two Adam Sandlers. We had to pay them both.
Dunkachino? Don't mind if I do.
Look, Al Pacino didn't do the Dunkachino bit without getting paid.
Yeah, I haven't seen Jack and Jill, but I did like pick out the Dunkachino bit on YouTube, and I woke up from a coma like the next day. It was like, like the most horrible crap.
There's a really wonderful, I want to see if I can find it. Hang on. There's a really wonderful Twitter account that I follow,
Is it just about the Dunkachino stuff?
It is.
Oh, no.
There is literally like an account for the hold on, let me see if I can find it. Come on, buddy. I retweeted you not that long ago.
To elucidate, Jack and Jill was a 2011 film directed by Dennis Dugan. It stars Adam Sandler as a brother and a sister. He plays both roles, and they're special effects.
They're twins.
Comedy ensues just because they're both annoying people, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he's embarrassed by her because she's shrill and
He plays
very outgoing.
He plays an ad executive in that movie, and he's trying to think of a good ad campaign for Dunkin' Donuts, playing themselves in the movie. And he's able to get Al Pacino to sell an imaginary Dunkin' Donuts project.
Well, that's the whole goal.
Called a Dunkachino. And they actually get Al Pacino to rap the Dunkachino theme.
Yeah. Okay.
In this fake Dunkin' Donuts ad.
It's actually pretty glorious, and I do appreciate that. And then the movie ends with Al Pacino saying, they look at the commercial, and Adam Sandler's like, eh? And Al Pacino's like, you were burning every negative of this. this will never see the light of day. I regret every second of this.
The irony is, it's in the movie, so...
Yeah,
you know,
so it's forever.
We're going to see it anyway.
There's a Twitter account called at Daily Dunkachino. DUNKACCINO. And the whole gag is, every day, they tweet one variation on the Dunkachino scene. Sometimes it's like, Dunkachino, but like everything is like a 1 second off sync. Or it's Dunkachino, but instead of the music they use in the film, we're actually putting it next to like David Bowie's Golden Years or something. There's a really amazing one that I quote that I like retweeted today on my account that was Dunkachino, but it's a reconstructed Doctor Who episode from the 1960s. So it's like a whole bunch of like the still images.
And they put like the captions up to describe what's going on.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
It's actually really, really, really funny because the whole thing is like, oh yes, we're on it. We're hiding from the master and we have to keep this piece of technology from him. This seems like a good place to hide out. Something quiet where nothing interesting happens. Apparently, this is their note on it. A few things to note about this entry. One, it's written in a way where it can actually fit in before the episode Volcano without messing up the storylines. Two, the credit sequence is accurate, like, extremely. And three, Peter Purvis from the original Doctor Who actually reprised his role for this.
Like, they called him up and had him record some lines.
Actual actor.
Oh my god.
That's amazing. So kudos to everyone who's been keeping the Daily Dunkachino. They're talking about how they're gonna like eventually like retire the, they're gonna leave it up, but just not gonna bother updating it anymore because the jokes run its course, but they're gonna run for like one more month. So if you have anything you want to submit, do it. There's so many fun ones on there. So if nothing else, Jack and Jill brought us that. Anyway, moving on.
Let's talk about other movies. We talked too long about this movie that was too long. Mm. I saw another horror movie.
Okay.
I saw a movie called Seance. Seance is the feature directorial debut of Simon Barrett, a screenwriter who's done The Guest and You're Next and a few other exciting recent horror entries. This is his first film that he's directed. And it is about, it's a slasher film set at a girl's boarding school. Years ago, a seance went wrong and someone fell out a window and died. And now we've fast forwarded to the present. Suki Waterhouse plays a young girl who is now staying in the dead girl's room. And shenanigans begin to ensue again. And you're not really sure if there is a masked killer is wearing this creepy papier-mâché mask, chasing people around and killing them on the anniversary of that death, or if there's actually something supernatural going on thanks to another seance just occurred.
I'm bummed I missed this because I'm actually generally a fan of Simon Barrett's screenplays. This is from the writer of The Guest.
I did say that.
No, I'm saying, I just want to clarify. Like that means a lot to me.
the Guest is an excellent movie. It's one of the best films of the decade.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I'm not allowed to really review it anymore because like one of the actors in The Guest is like my partner in the Movie Trivia Schmodown. But before that happened, I was calling The Guest one of the best films of the decade, and you can look that up if you really wanted to. I love that movie. So I really want to see this. I'm bummed. I actually had a migraine today, and I wasn't able to like get anything done. I really wanted to see this. The one question I have for you, because this is important, I think, to any slasher movie, what does the mask look like?
Because
I think this is something that I think about.
Remember Hell Knight? Looks kind of like the mask from Hell Knight.
Not really. Which one was Hell Knight?
That was the one, the slasher at the amusement park.
Oh, yeah. You mean the one that came out like a couple of years ago?
Or was it Hellfest?
Hellfest was the one from a couple of years ago.
Oh, then it was that one.
Okay.
No, it's called Hell.
Was it? There's a couple. Hang on.
It's either Hell Night or Hellfest.
Hold on, Hell Night. Hell Night is a 1981 slasher movie.
Okay, then it was Hellfest. I apologize.
Okay,
Hellfest. It looks like the mask from Hellfest.
Okay,
which was a set at a, like haunted, like a not scary farm sort of amusement park night, and there was a guy in a mask killing people.
Great idea, not a good execution.
I thought it was fine enough. Yeah, it was.
I love the attention to detail. Yeah. I just thought the scares were subpar. Yeah. But in any case, fine. I just, whenever I think of like, oh, I should write a slasher someday, the one thing I can't get over is, what's the mask gonna be? It's gotta be good. You gotta have a good mask. Yeah, you gotta have a good look.
The baby mascot mask and Happy Death Day was a notably good one.
Yeah, maybe the best of the modern era, I think.
The thing is, I can't tell if Seance is trying to be retro or if it's trying to reintroduce slashers. If it's trying to be new or if it's trying to be a throwback. It's been a while since the heyday of the slashers. Mm-hmm. It's been a while since the revival of the slashers, thanks to that post-Scream era in the 90s.
Yeah, slashers really became a genre after around Halloween and Black Christmas. They were everywhere in the 80s.
They were introduced in the late 70s. In the 1980s, there was this gigantic boom of a genre of horror films that were typically whodunits, sometimes supernatural, about a killer who was stalking a group of characters and killing them off one by one.
Cheap to produce, profitable. Yeah. It became supplanted by other cheap to produce horror movies like found footage or zombies. This fell out of favor. Scream brought it back for about 5-6 years, really popular, and then it just died again.
But Scream was sort of like a riff on it. It was like a self-aware thing because everybody had, at that point, all the characters in the movie had seen all the slashers and they could have recognized when they were in a slasher situation.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of self-awareness in Scream. But it also functions as a slasher.
It is the thing it's satirizing, which makes it a great satire.
But slashers and even revival slashers have been out of the public eye for so long that to make it now, one could perhaps say that Simon Barrett is trying to revive them. Mm-hmm. He's trying to say, this is a form that's been ignored for a little bit, let's bring it back. But there's no originality here. There's no surprises here. There's no twist on the material that it could just be he's doing really tired material.
He's just doing the classical slasher.
I think he is merely 20 years out of date.
Okay. Is that so bad?
Well, yes, if it's not an entertaining movie.
That's my question. That's what it boils down to, isn't it?
If it's 20 years out of date and it's really cliched, you know, from something that was old 20 years ago, then, yeah, that's particularly grievous, isn't it?
When I reviewed Spiral last week, you know, my whole thing was it's basically Saw by way of, like, Kiss the Girls or Along Came a Spider. It's the very 90s serial killer movie version of that. Right. And my issue wasn't with the idea behind that. My issue wasn't that that was a familiar form. My issue was it just wasn't written very well. So is it just flat or is it just so predictable because you've seen it? What is the really thing hiding it back? It gets to be like it's not fun. Like what makes it not fun?
What I just said. They're not bringing anything new to this material.
Is new really that important?
I understand that when it comes to slasher movies, banality is part of the charm.
Well, at least familiarity.
It has to be incredibly predictable. That's kind of why we go. We like to sort of count off the beats as they progress as audience members.
I've been charmed by formulaic rom-coms, for example.
Yeah, but you know there has to be a little bit of character or a little bit of charm, and Simon Barrett hasn't brought any of that.
That's a shame.
There is a little bit of a queer element, which I think is kind of fun, but when it's revealed what is actually going on, who the killers might or might not have been, it doesn't really bring any kind of surprise. There's no new twist to this sort of material. It's just, of course it was X because it was pointing that way. There's all the predictable scenes where everybody says, oh no, there's a killer among us. Well, I better break off and go be by myself in this one location where somebody can slash my throat. And lo, it happens. It would have been boring in 1996. It would have been boring in 1985.
Okay.
And now it's just boring in 2021.
That is brutal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put that on Rotten Tomatoes. That's brutal. Jesus.
So it's not incompetently filmed. Simon Barrett knows how these slasher films work, and he's, you know, pretty proficient at constructing it solidly, but he's constructing something that we had discarded a long time ago.
Well, here's another way of looking at it. Maybe This is his feature directorial debut.
Yeah.
Is it, do you think it's maybe just testing the waters, just seeing if he knows how to make a movie?
Okay.
Is that...
Why release that to the public? Try it on your own. Figure it out and then make your movie. All right. Okay. I don't have to sit here and let you test your waters. Okay. He knows how to write exciting, different kinds of movies.
Well, fair enough. I think if it sounds like I'm grilling you, it's because this tends to be the kind of genre I can be a little forgiving of, because I think familiarity is caked into it.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I just defended Hellfest. You know, that's another
movie I thought sucked.
I think that's another pretty typical slasher movie. It does rely on a lot of tropes, but I liked the characters, I liked some of the actors, and I liked the setting. And I think there was just a lot more visually interesting things happening in that.
Yeah. Something to rescue it. Something to make it pop out. Yeah.
Yeah, this is just young women being picked off in a women's dormitory. It's like, you know what? You can't do that after Suspiria. You can't do that at the other Suspiria either. It's like, we've seen it now, and you know, do something. If you're going to do something really retro, try to at least comment on it in some way.
Well, okay. Well, that's a shame. Hmm. What else have we got for this week?
I also saw, do you want me to hear about the World War II documentary?
Sure, why not?
Do you want to hear about the coming of age comedy?
Let's do the World War something documentary. Which, two?
Yes, World War II.
Let's do the World War II documentary, because it's the easiest segue.
Yeah, from a slasher film, we go to a documentary film, which is a series of, it's directed by Luke Holland, and it's a series of interviews with the last surviving people who participated in World War II.
Okay.
And it's
we're running out.
Yeah. So they're elderly people who talk about how they were, as kids, part of the Hitler Youth Program.
Oh, my God.
How they were... There are a few interviews with people who were like trying to spirit away potential victims, but most of these people were German citizens.
So this is a German documentary.
This is a German documentary about German people.
Wow.
And how they feel about it now, and how the atrocities of World War II are perceived in the minds of the people who were there. There are a few incredibly damning interviews. A lot of the people interviewed are just incredibly saddened by what happened, because they were very young at the time, or they were they might have been sort of in the military, but they weren't fighting on the front lines, and they weren't participating in the camps. They were just sort of like training. They were in reserve, and they weren't getting all the information, so they thought everything was just hunky dory. It was like Boy Scouts.
Well, that's the line, "All quiet on the Western Front," which is supposedly like everything's fine. Well, even though it's not.
And that's something that I think was exploited to great effect in the film Jojo Rabbit, about a young boy who thinks that being a Nazi is just real keen, and this Hitler is like a hero type character.
Because all he gets is the propaganda.
Exactly. Yeah. And because he's eight, he believes it all. So this is about people who were like Jojo Rabbit. They just sort of went off to the military, and boy howdy, isn't this fun. And it wasn't until many years later, and it took them decades to sort of reconcile the fact that they were taking part in this war effort. Some of them think that that was fine. That their experience was actually very positive. There's somebody who, one of the guys they talked to is like, well, yeah, we were doing this. And what do you think of the solution? Well, I mean, I don't agree with it, but there's a really kind of self-reflective scene where one of these fellows is at sort of a meeting, a political meeting with some younger people, talking about the war and his experience in the war, and he is explaining that he is ashamed to be German because his government, when he was young, took part in all of these atrocities, and he also took part in these atrocities. Like, he didn't murder anybody, but he was there for it.
Yeah, he didn't stop it. Yeah.
And off camera, we hear the words of this other like younger upstart saying, "But now wait a minute, surely there was like some." Are you saying you're ashamed to be German? You should be proud to be German, and you know we should actually think about keeping German. And he uses the word pure, and starts bringing up like things about Algerians out of nowhere, and it's like really bizarre. And he shouts this younger guy down, saying, "No, we should be ashamed. This is not something to aspire to or to think about. This is something to reject."
Yeah.
So that's a really a penetrating moment. And at the end of the film, one of the interviewees says that, and this is kind of the most condemning thing about nationalism and national identity and war in general.
Yeah.
We all saw what was happening. We may have hated it. We may have protested it, but none of us walked away. Mm-hmm. And I think during times of uprising and times of war and times of atrocity, that's going to be a pretty natural human response, is to just sort of go along and keep your head down.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's survival. Yeah. You're trying to just get by yourself.
It's not that you're necessarily under threat. It's just that you don't want to make the effort.
Yeah.
To walk away. And
there's
a lot in this film that will just, it'll make your heart ache and it'll make your head hurt, because that amount of evil is difficult to hold in your imagination.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to understand what a gigantic violation of human nature all of World War II was.
Yeah.
And how much it violated and how much it tore down in terms of not just the way we do combat, but in the way we think about death and destruction.
Like, the trauma of that worldwide event has just these ripple effects we can't even calculate anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And we're still living through it.
Yeah.
It's still part of the conversation.
No, when you
very
think about,
active living part
when
of
you
it.
Think about, like, how this, you can look at, like, it's just studies of how trauma or undiagnosed, scars, mental scars, can, like, affect multiple generations of a family. You know, like this, like one grandparent was abusive, and then that just affects every successive generation in a cascade and not sometimes unpredictable ways. And then you realize that that was like a whole generation on the planet was directly or indirectly completely changed by this.
Yeah.
And how that we're still living through that. And there now we're in this weird wave where people are like not taking it as seriously as they used to because they can't even process just how evil it was.
Yeah.
And just how fucking horrifying it is.
So it's become a cliche in Hollywood that World War II is sort of like easy pickings when it comes to drama. And it makes sense. It's a hugely dramatic time.
Yeah.
There are hundreds and hundreds of movies set during World War II about the war. Going back to the war itself that were being made at the time. You know, you go back to something like Mrs. Miniver that was made during the war, or all the way up to like The Zookeeper's Wife. There's these movies about World War II to the point where. Some audiences got pretty cynical about it, and there's that famous speech in the TV show Extras about how Kate Winslet said, if you want to win an Oscar, just make a World War II movie.
Which is how she ended up winning an Oscar.
She won an Oscar for a World War II movie. Yeah. And smart money is bet on the World War II movie if you have an Oscar pool. I think what Final Account is doing is kind of bringing it back around again, because it's actually interviewing the people who were there.
We need to be reminded of like what it was like to be there, and not the Hollywood obvious version where Indiana Jones punches out Hitler, like, you know, or Captain America.
We need an account. We need a final account, which is the title of the film. Mm-hmm. So it's a rough sit, but I think it's incredibly vital.
Okay. That's awesome. Yeah. Where is it available?
I think it's on demand.
Okay.
You can get it like on some on demand places.
Okay, great. Well, and then major subject shift, because I suspect it says little to do with the horrors of World War II. Drunk Bus.
Drunk Bus is a lighthearted romp. Well, it's actually not so lighthearted. This is an indie coming of age drama about a young man who drives the drunk bus around his old college. He's graduated from college. His girlfriend moved away to New York and he didn't want to follow her. So now he's just sort of sticking around driving the drunk bus and just bemoaning his situation. The drunk bus, by the way, is the last bus of the night that all of the drunken college students get on when they ride back to their dorm rooms. And so they're all drunk on it. He regularly cleans up vomit and poop. He has to deal with all of these drunks, and his life is miserable. When he's accosted on the bus one evening, he's given a bodyguard. He's this guy named Pineapple. He's played by an actor named Pineapple.
Yeah.
Pineapple, Tengaroa, Pineapple Tengaroa is the actor's name. And he's this Maori guy with facial tattoos and a lot of piercings. And even though he's really like this intimidating bouncer type because he's really huge, he's actually incredibly warm, and he starts to take control of this kid's life and teach him to sort of loosen up a little bit. Teaches him to shoplift and get drunk himself and lose his virginity. It's all kind of very male-centric coming-of-age stuff. And so by the end, it's about how he's going to sort of regain his self-respect, maybe get back with his girlfriend, or maybe develop a relationship with a new young woman in his life. I've always resented that these sort of coming-of-age dramas are typically facilitated by drugs.
Mm-hmm.
It's always about a sober person who learns to loosen up a little bit by getting drunk or taking weed.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be fun if it was like heroin?
just skip it. Yeah.
It's like, you need to loosen up a bit. Here's some heroin. I took heroin and wow, my life is so much better
Look,
now.
It's a screenwriting shorthand. You want to have a situation where someone who normally wouldn't let loose, lets loose. And rather than go through all the complex issues of getting them to a place where they feel comfortable, relaxing, experimenting, being social. Right. That takes time, effort. We don't have that much time. We have one scene to get to the point where they're like
they're gonna do something brave, and they can only be brave if they're intoxicated.
Yeah, it's a cheat. It's like the game.
The game wizard.
Remember that thing? There was like this thing you could put like your
the
Mario.
The game genie.
Yeah. There's this thing in old cartridge based video games where you could put this thing called a game genie in like your Super Nintendo, and then you could put your cartridge in the game genie, and the game genie would basically give you like the development kit, so you could like run the game faster, slower.
Run faster. You could do slow motion. You could get extra lives.
You could jump fire.
Instant power ups. All the rest of that.
It's basically a big old cheat code. Yeah.
It was a little cheat widget. I never had a game genie. I never wanted one. Yeah. I didn't want the purity of my games interrupted, man.
I did.
you just wanted to beat him.
Made him a lot easier, man. Not gonna lie.
that's true. But what I do appreciate about this movie is some of the chemistry between the characters. A film like this is going to live or die based on sort of the uniqueness of its scenario and the warmth between its characters. And I think Pineapple Tangaroa is actually a really stirring presence. His warmth makes him feel more like a real character rather than just this magical character who exists in order to facilitate the growth of a white boy. I don't want to use Spike Lee's term for the character, but it kind of evokes that a little bit.
That's a shame.
But luckily, he is an interesting enough person, and he's kind of playing himself that it just makes me want to see more movies with him.
That's good.
I think he has good chemistry with all of the people around him, and he ends up making friends really, really well. And he has a few great moments where he like talks to people on the phone and just instantly wins them over. So there's a few fun scenes with the pineapple character, but overall, it seems like a pretty typical kind of a drama. The main character is played by Charlie Tan, who is on that TV show. I think on Ozark, which I haven't seen, but I was assured that Ozark is good.
I've heard
Amy Nicholson pointed this out to me that he was really good on Ozark, but I haven't seen Ozark.
Cool.
And the young woman who is like his best friend is played by Kara Hayward. From Moonlight Kingdom, and she was also in that movie To the Stars last year.
Yeah, she's really good.
Really liked. So I'm keeping an eye on her. I hope her career takes an upswing.
That's awesome. Okay, well, it's time to review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. This is just sort of a refresher. We review films on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest a movie can get, unless the movie is Cats, is a C-. That means it's below average. And that's everything from we just don't recommend it to it's the worst thing we've ever seen. C is average. There's some good. There's some bad. It's all just sort of meh. And then C+ is above average. Well, that means we genuinely recommend it, or we think it's the best thing ever made, or somewhere in the middle. And that's how we don't end up on movie posters. Mm-hmm. And let's take it away. So, Drunk Bus on the critically acclaimed scale.
Drunk Bus is a C. Okay. There's just enough charm to recommend it.
All right. Let's see what we got here. Final Account.
Final Account is a C+. It's heady. Mm. And it might feel a little bit too much like a classroom watch to some people, but I think it's really kind of a vital film. I think you really should. Do your your own idea of history a favor and, okay. and watch Final Account.
All right, and Seance.
Seance, golly, I wish I could recommend it because I can clearly see some talent behind the camera, but I just wish he had made a more interesting movie. So it's a C-.
That's a shame. And Army of the Dead.
Army of the Dead, big, colorful, energetic portions, but ultimately it just sort of flopped for me, so I'm going to give it a C-.
Okay, I'm going to give it a very mild C+.
Okay.
Like, very, very mild. Just like, listen, it is what you want it to be, and probably a little too much more, but I had an entertaining time. I'm not going to pretend that I didn't. Even the things that I don't like about it didn't really ruin it. I just was rolling my eyes going, this is more stupid than it needs to be. Or not stupid enough in some cases. But ultimately, I had a good time. So I really can't complain too much.
I like Tig Notaro.
She's good. She steals the movie.
She's also one of the better parts of Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, she's, I didn't know that.
She plays one of the engineers who like will show up in like an every third episode or so. She'll like kind of come out of a hallway and say, oh God, what is it now? It's like, we're all going to die. Oh, thank God. Like... She's just like the cynical, depressed engineer who like kind of like floats through the room every once in a while.
She's rapidly. I mean, it's weird because you know she's not like, you know, fresh out of college or anything like that. But she's rapidly becoming one of my favorite character actors. Just anytime she shows up, it's just like, well, this scene's gonna be good. I don't have to worry about a thing while she's on the camera. She's great, and she's only just relatively recently got into like acting a lot. And we're better off for having her. So, more take, please. All right, that's it for the new releases. Let's talk about the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. Once again, you can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And all of our patrons, even $1 a month, you get to vote for episodes of this show, where we pick our streaming club option of the month. We vote for episodes of Cancel Too Soon and other stuff as well. Everyone gets a vote. And every week, we or however often we can get this podcast out, but we go for weekly. We ask you to pick. We pick a streaming service, and we pick a subsection of that streaming service. It might be a genre or a decade or something similar. And then we give you four options. Whitney chooses two, and I choose two. Each of us chooses two films that we either have never seen or maybe we haven't seen since we were a little kid and we barely remember. That's as far as we're allowed to go. And then you tell us what to watch. And this time, your options were Italian films on the Criterion Collection.
Criterion Channel.
Well, yeah. Six of one, half a dozen, but fair enough.
Collection, I think, is specifically their home video line.
Yeah, but I feel like if they're on...
But that is their physical media line. I can't say home video anymore because it's all home video.
But well, yeah. But in any case, yeah, it's on the Criterion Channel, and they have a lot of Italian movies.
Oh, heck yes.
They have a lot of international cinema, and they have a lot of Italian movies. Italian cinema is very formative in the industry. In particular, there's several movements in Italy, and I think maybe the most significant one, and it's really relevant to the movie we're about to talk about, is the Italian neorealist movement, which is a really fascinating time. If you look at the early history of Italian cinema, especially around the time of World War II, it wasn't really like a lot of hard-hitting, gritty stuff. It was a lot of placate the masses kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's actually a term for it called white telephone movies, where characters would have these like fancy white telephones, and it was just became
to denote their wealth.
Yeah, it became a symbol of escapist bourgeois bullshit.
Yeah,
and in response to that, at the end of World War II, we started to see a wave of films in Italy coming from filmmakers who were desperate to make films to tell stories that evoked real life. And these were stripped down. These were not glitzy. These were shot like in on the fly documentary style, a lot of them. And they showed real people in real struggles, even if they were highly refined stories, something like Umberto Day or The Bicycle Thieves, which are both like wonderful screenplays, but they felt naturalistic.
Yeah.
And that mentality filtered forward into a film that, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, is often called one of the best films ever made. And having finally seen it, I'm not going to fight that too hard. It's called The Battle of Algiers, directed by Gillo Pontecorvo. Sorry. embarrassed that I got that wrong all these years.
Oh, it's the Gillo Pontecorvo. This is an Italian-Algerian co-production, and it takes place during the Battle of Algiers, which was actually a really notable time in Algerian history. When France was France occupied Algeria for the longest time, and they were being pushed out by the Liberation Front, the local guerrilla fighters who were sort of advancing. And
this is the this is in the mid to late 50s for the most part. Yeah.
The film was made in 1966.
So it's really recent history at the time.
But yeah, it takes place over the course of the late 50s. And it just is not... There are two main characters, but more than anything, it's just about sort of the two sides.
Yeah.
How the guerrillas, the guerrilla fighters will advance a little bit and the military will push back really hard to re-solidify their
dominance.
Their dominance in the area. Well, and then the guerrillas will push back some more. There's gunfire and bombings and all this and misery.
Torture.
The film opens with a scene of torture. They just got done torturing a guy.
Yeah, and now they're really blasé about it.
And it's like he's shirtless and he's like shivering and he's still in pain. It's like, get this guy some coffee. He ratted out his friends.
Yeah.
So yeah, what a great note to start on.
Yeah, it's really brutal and just really just kicks into high gear right away.
And Gillo Pontecorvo films this in a really immediate documentary style, which was pretty novel at the time in that there's a lot of handheld camera work.
Yeah.
There's a lot of chasing people up and down streets. You get a great sense as to where everything is
in relation to
each other.
The sense...
they call it spatial continuity, and it's better in this movie than it is in most movies.
The spatial continuity in this movie, it's really interesting. Like, this is one of those movies where you watch it and then especially if you've been watching movies for a long time, if you watch it now for the first time, a lot of shit suddenly clicks into place. Like you realize which filmmakers love this movie. Like Christopher Nolan loves this movie.
Oh yeah,
you can tell. And like a lot of it, like, and he's talked about it apparently, like The Dark Knight Rises, the level of like civil unrest in that movie is taken like directly from this movie. But also the way that he's just the way that he presents his cityscapes and the way that he wants you to be aware. Some movies don't want you to be aware of the city that they're in, often because
they're not filming in the city that it takes place.
Yeah, they're filming in a lot of alleys, filming a lot of places that could be anywhere. That's not the Battle of Algiers. The Battle of Algiers is just absolutely impeccably placed. Like, you know where you are. You know where the streets go. You have these incredible, like, wide shots of the entire city, and it does feel like reporter footage. It feels like news footage. And when this movie came out in America, there were actually disclaimers reminding people, telling people that none of this is a documentary footage. Because otherwise it could very easily be mistaken for it. And that's a technique that's became more popular over time. This, like, you are here thing. Paul Greengrass has been using that to great effect ever since. It gave his Bourne movies a sense of immediacy that, frankly, distracted people from how stupid a lot of those movies are. Like, tell me the plot of The Bourne Ultimatum. I'll wait. It's weird and it's ridiculous and it's fine.
Is that the one with the Chems?
No, Chems is Bourne Legacy. He didn't do one, to be fair. anyway, my point is this. This level of immediacy, this level of making sure the audience is hyper aware of their sense of place and that place feels realistic, can elevate even junky material and make it seem like extra important, because you really do feel like you're there. You really do feel like it's real. And when you have actually good material, it becomes fucking phenomenal, as it does in the Battle of Algiers. So the basic storyline is, you're right, it's kind of a two-hander. Mm. We follow the National Liberation Front, or in the way the acronym works in the actual language, it's the FLN.
Yeah.
And we're following a lot of people who they don't like being occupied by the French. The French are dicks. So they initially do general sort of civil unrest things. There are fights, a couple of shootouts. And then when the police respond with more oppression, with more fascism, with more kidnappings, with more torture, and then eventually more civilians being dead as a result of the French, the situation just keeps escalating on both sides. And to the point where you can totally see where the Ethel line is coming from. You can feel that anger. Yeah. You can feel that sense that there's no hope here and all we can do is lash out. Otherwise, we have no dignity. And the planning, the guerrilla warfare tactics that are vividly illustrated in this film are fascinating. It's fascinating to see them planned, to see them play out, see bombings prepared in public situations. It's fascinating to see the way that Gio Pontecorvo manages to humanize both sides. They're human beings, even though the film is very clearly pro one side more than the other.
Yeah, it's clearly on the side of the FLN. And,
But it does think that all human life is precious. I do think it appreciates that much, but like beyond
it's,
that,
It's not so hateful of the military that it's going to like have fun murdering them.
No.
Because these are human lives, and murder is you know a grievous crime.
But the movie clearly agrees that one side is more wrong than the other a lot.
In fact, the face of these two sides, we have on the one side a character named Ali Lapointe, who is played by an actor named Brahim Hajjaj, who represents the face of the FLN, and he's sort of like an agent of a lot of the violence in that he's sort of enlisted by the FLN to do a lot of these missions.
He's very much an everyman. He's illiterate, but he's very passionate, and he's very, very principled.
I think there's a really wonderful scene where he gets his instructions in writing, but he can't read, so he hands it to a young boy to read it to him. So hearing these words coming out of the young boy's mouth is pretty dramatic.
And the boy is saying some fucked up shit, like, okay, there's a police informant working at this restaurant. We need you to go to that restaurant, wait for the policeman to show up, follow the policeman, and then kill the policeman. And this is like an 8-year-old saying this.
You have to kill the
it's
police.
Really heavy, yeah.
Meanwhile, the French army eventually has to enlist like an expert, essentially.
Yeah.
And that is Colonel Mathieu, played by Jean Martin.
Jean Martin is the only professional, like, lifelong actor in the crew. But he is actually interesting. Like, he actually, like, lost work because he was very like pro Algerian independence so he was very passionate about this project,
and he's playing this character and here's what I like about the Colonel character is that he's presented the same way a lot of military experts are in most military movies. A lot of military movies are very pro-war, or at the very least make war seem very exciting.
Or at the very least pro-military.
Pro-military. Yeah. And so he's a very efficient soldier. He knows how to wrangle his army in a new kind of way. He's a very good commander. He has a good sense of the geography of the place, and he knows where to place his soldiers.
He's been given an assignment, and he will approach it with the same degree of zeal and efficiency that they would in a movie like Guns of Navarone.
There you go. But in a film like Guns of Navarone is very... I hope the mission succeeds. It's all about...
It's morally clear.
Yeah. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys, and we're going to blow them up. It's war. Yeah. All right, everybody's going to die here.
Yeah.
But... what Gio Pontecorvo is showing us is that it doesn't matter how good you are as a soldier, war doesn't continue without guys like this. These are the people who, in their efficiency, is just perpetuating the violence and the misery.
There's a great...
They're not here to seal the deal. They're not here to get the mission done and then it's over. They're just here to make sure the machinery keeps moving at a more efficient way.
There's a great scene in this movie where there's actually quite a few scenes where like there's a press conference. And there's a scene in the movie where the press is asking this what is he, like a colonel or a captain?
He's a
colonel. They're asking him questions about this, what's going on and all the tactics that he's using. And there's a lot of people just sort of dancing around the subject. And finally, one reporter just says, hey, we're all afraid to say the words. So I'm just going to say it. You're torturing people to get information. That's bad. Talk about that. Like this and the guy's like, do you want to ask a real question? Like, we all asked the questions. I'm just actually going to ask you to be direct about it. You're torturing people. That's immoral. Talk about that. And the guy just says in very calm terms, I have been given a very difficult task. I am responsible for extracting information from people very quickly, and I'm willing to do that. And that's it. He's not apologizing for it. He's not even saying he's not doing it. He's just saying, this is a practicality, and I will do that. He's Jack Bauer in 24. Yeah, like, if it takes cutting off a guy's head to find out where the nerve agent is, I will do it, because I feel the ends justify the means. And that's a horrible, that's a horrible philosophy to have in any situation like this.
The difference between Jack Bauer and the Colonel is that Jack Bauer is, he's angered by what he sees, and he feels like things... It's a very 24 is a very immediate show. It's all about, I need it right now. So he kind of resorts to violence really quickly because there's not a lot of time otherwise. There's even an episode where Jack Bauer like shocks a guy as tied to a chair with like a cord from a lamp. Like he's electrocuting the guy. And he's like, I don't know. It's like, clearly he doesn't know anything. And the guy standing next to him stabs him in the kneecap. He's like, okay, I'll tell you now. And Jack Bauer's like, well, darn, I guess I wasn't torturing hard enough. Like, that's the lesson he's learning from this scene.
That show is aged poorly.
It's so fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, it's thrilling television.
Oh, it's undeniably thrilling television, but it's...
despicable morals.
Yeah, morally, it's fucked. Yeah.
Like, I enjoy watching it, but yeah, its morals are just awful.
Yeah.
The Colonel character doesn't have that kind of action-packed immediacy that Jack Bauer does. He's amoral. He doesn't care.
Well, he says...
He's just trying to get the job done in the only way he knows how. He has no tools in his toolbox.
I agree with that. However, I will say this. He does specifically say that he has... That the people that he is torturing, and he should not be doing that, but the people that he is torturing have been told by their superiors in the Liberation Front... that don't say anything for 24 hours, then say everything you want. Because by that point, they will have made any information they could give you irrelevant. So he says he is chasing a clock. So he is in his head Jack Bauer, I think.
Maybe so.
But it's bullshit. It's bullshit justification.
But Gila Pontecorvo doesn't let him have any heroism.
No, in fact...
He doesn't let any of the military characters have heroism.
In fact, after right around that moment, we actually have an extended montage of the torture techniques that they're doing, and they're clearly crimes against humanity. They're clearly despicable.
And no one would approve of this.
No one. No one in their right mind would say this is fine. Unless there was some sort of weird nationalist indoctrination thing going on. And again, the guy even just says, like, listen, the French are here in Algeria. No one's suggesting the French should leave Algeria, except for the Liberation Front.
No one except for everyone.
We all agree that the French should be here, so we'll stay here at any cost. And I'm like, you are making a lot of faulty assumptions in order to make that argument. But it just shows you how close-minded that level of colonialism is.
Colonialism is the end, they'll do anything to keep it on.
We see the other side of the conflicts. We see the Liberation Front. And again, the movie sympathies are clearly there. However, it's also the logical sympathy. Where there are scenes in this movie where people who seem like good people and they have our sympathies commit atrocities. They put bombs in public places where civilians who have no direct connection to anything other than they're living in and benefiting from this form of occupation, which is bad, but I don't know if it's a death sentence bad. But we see them placing bombs, and it's like right out of that Hitchcock movie Sabotage. Like, there's a ticking clock. Will they be able to hide the thing behind the jukebox in time? Will anyone notice them? There's a lot of suspense. But we do get all of these moments with all the victims of those bombings as well. Yeah. I realize that also does suck. But nothing that anyone... Like... they're desperately trying to be heard. And no one's hearing them through any other channel. And so you get that sense, you understand their sense of desperation. You understand how just absolutely vital it is for them to change their circumstances however they can, even if we disapprove of methods, but other methods aren't working. There's a scene, there's an extended sequence in the movie where they try to simply have a strike. No one's going to go to work, and they're hoping that the United Nations notices their strike and pays attention to them. However, if you're striking, it means you support the Liberation Front. So that anyone who's home right now has a target on their head from the French police. So they take that moment to escalate the situation and try to force people, like, bust them into places and force them to work. And they're not allowed to do anything else. There's nothing is working. It is this incredible encapsulation of the self-perpetuating cycle of political occupation and and war. And it's unbelievably gripping.
It's exciting filmmaking with a point to it.
Yeah.
And that it is trying to point that out, that cycle.
Yeah.
Where pushing back and pushing back. And it's about war, but more than anything, it is about that, the colonialism.
Yeah.
It is about the system of oppression and the lengths to which it is going to go in order to hang on to its grip on the world.
Yeah.
And when you look at a lot of modern political parties, you're going to start seeing a lot of actual parallels.
Yeah.
The death grip of the colonizer's myth is not going to be loosened on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to pry the fingers up one by one. And I feel like that's what the Battle of Algiers is trying to do. It is trying to wrest colonialism away from the colonizers how that is never going to be an easy task.
If you are even half paying attention to global politics right now, like if you're just paying attention to what's trending on Twitter, and seeing what's going on in, say, the Middle East, and you watch the Battle of Algiers, you will feel like, oh, this movie could have been made today.
Yeah,
it would have been about the Algeria, but it would have been clearly a parallel for what's going on right now. This is a cycle that does not end on its own.
Yeah.
It needs to be stopped. It needs actual people in power to stop it. And it takes a lot to get their attention because they don't care a lot of the time. This is a movie that was incredibly influential, not just to filmmakers, but to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, actual, like, other liberation fronts would, like, watch this movie. and not just for motivation, but to actually, like, study tactics.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Panthers watched this.
This was shown, like, on military bases.
Yeah. And indeed,
there are soldiers who have talked about watching the Battle of Algiers.
The Pentagon screened this movie around the time of the Iraq War.
Mm.
The most recent one, when it started around, like, in 2003. And they specifically screened it because it's an example of the French in this movie have a strategic victory. All right. Technically, at some point in the movie, they accomplished their goal of stifling this insurgency. But what they didn't do was anything to prevent an uprising in the long term.
Yeah.
They weren't successful at stamping out resistance. They just stopped it for a minute. They weren't thinking in the long game, which is really fucking funny when you think about how America handled that war in the long term because they didn't do that shit. Now, did they? They just perpetuated a whole bunch of bullshit. So annoying. They learned all the wrong lessons. I don't know how they did it. No, I know.
I know how they did it.
Fucking sucks. But anyway, this is a must-see film. And I'm so glad I finally saw it. I wasn't resisting it. It just never came up. And I'm so glad I took the time. Thank you, everybody who voted for it. You made a great choice.
This was one that was taught me in school. I think it is taught in a lot of film schools. And yeah, it was just one that, thanks to a professor, I fell in love with it. And eventually it showed up on the Criterion Collection, and I got the DVD. And now, it's on the Criterion Channel, and it's on HBO, if you have either of those services.
Funnily enough, the first film class I ever took when I went to film school at UCLA was a class called Film and Social Change. And it was all about movies that either directly inspired or represented major cultural shifts in the world. And it was all about world cinema. I watched a lot of great world cinemas. And I was a wonderful professor who is sadly no longer with us, named Tashoma Gabriel. And he very pointedly did not show Battle of Algiers. He showed us another Gillo Pontecorvo film called Burn, or Quemada, which is fucking great.
And I haven't seen Burn.
People don't talk about Burn enough, and I just want to make a point. You should check it out, because it's another amazing movie about colonialism where Marlon Brando is like sent to, I think, the Caribbean to start an uprising amongst slaves who are working on like sugarcane in order to kick the French off of an island so that England could colonize it. And he does it very successfully, and that's the first half of the movie. The second half of the movie, he's called back because he did too good a job, and they're still rebelling. You inspired them to rebel, and they won't stop now. You have to stop them now, and you can't. you can't just put that genie back in a bottle. Incredible movie. Marlon Brando considered it one of his best movies and performances, and I am inclined to agree. So it doesn't get talked about a lot. So if you like Battle of Algiers, and I'd be surprised if you didn't at least find it interesting, I highly recommend checking out Burn, a.k.a. Quemada. It's usually found under Burn in America. So I hope you check that one out. But the Battle of Algiers, it's, if you don't have Criterion Channel, it is also on HBO Max. So it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
And that... it's critically acclaimed for this week. Next week, we'll be reviewing... actually, it's we've got a summer.
Summer movie season is actually beginning.
Yeah, some of the delayed movies are finally coming out. And so next week, we have A Quiet Place 2, which was just about to come out when the pandemic hit last year.
It went quiet, you might say.
Yeah. And we're also getting Disney's Cruella, the prequel origin story of Cruella de Vil, starring Academy Award winner Emma Stone and Academy Award winner Emma Thompson. And I hope every time they were on set, they're like, "Hey, Emma." I would love to be, I don't know, was it Craig Gillespie who directed Cruella?
Yeah, Craig Gillespie is the
director. If I'm Craig Gillespie, first day on set, I'm like, this is going to get confusing. You're Emma 1 and you're Emma 2. And Emma Stone's just like, "Why am I Emma 2? You know why. It's Emma Thompson.
Emma T and Emma S.
Fine. That's no disrespect to Emma Stone, but go on, Emma Thompson was there first.
But if you really, really wanted to know the complex backstory of the woman from the animated dog film, boy, howdy, you're going to get it.
You're going to get it next week.
So it's over 2 hours long.
And on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, we are having a poll on our Patreon for family movies on Tubi TV. And Tubi TV, as we've pointed out on many an occasion, is one of the weirdest streaming services. They're free, which means they show commercials. Sometimes very few commercials, actually. It's often very watchable. And their library is bizarre. It's very extensive.
It's like the cast-offs of all of the other streaming services.
All the shit that they don't want, but they don't know that it's good. They've got a lot of good shit. We did not pick the good shit for our Patreon.
No, we decided to go with family films. And,
well, that doesn't mean there aren't good family films.
We didn't pick
the good family films.
There are a few famous, infamous, notable family films on there that I have not seen.
You picked, without giving away who picked what, you picked two beloved films and I did not.
Okay.
So the films that are on the poll right now, this poll will be up for another day or so, are and it's a dead heat between three of them, by the way. Like, your vote really matters this week.
It matters every week.
It matters every week, but sometimes it's like clearly one has way more votes than the others. This time it's really, really close, and if you don't vote, you might completely change the landscape of next week's episode. So, but the nominees are Troop Beverly Hills, starring Shelley Long as a Beverly Hills socialite who decides to become a Girl Scout leader, but ends up teaching them about how to be Beverly Hills socialites. A Gnome Named Gnorm. I will say that again. A gnome named Gnorm.
No, ordinarily we would pronounce that word gnome, and however, if you've seen the film, the character is named Gnorm. And he pronounces it gnome.
Yeah, I'm
in fact, he corrects somebody, saying it's not gnome, it's gnome.
It's canon. It is
Gnome Named Gnorm.
It's a buddy cop movie. It's a buddy cop movie with Anthony Michael Hall, and his partner is a gnome, basically.
It's a puppet gnome.
Yeah, and it's one of only two films ever directed by Stan Winston. The other is?
Pumpkinhead.
Pumpkinhead. Let's see, we got A Cop and a Half, in which Burt Reynolds is a tough cop whose new partner is a little kid. He's half a cop.
Inspired by the film Mitchell.
Yeah. Really?
It was one of the jokes.
Oh, okay.
From Mystery Science Theater version of Mitchell.
I would not have been shocked if that was actually
Jodan Baker's like yelling at that kid, and Crow says, the inspiration for Cup and a Half.
There you go. And then the last nominee is Free Willy. Iconic 90s family film, an unexpected smash hit. And a lot of people grew up with it. One person at this table did not. Try to guess who.
Title was made fun of incessantly.
Of course.
Because it's a silly title.
It's a silly title. There's a lot of silly stuff in it. But this movie was a smash hit. It spawned at least two sequels. I think it was two, right?
I think it was three now, actually.
Is it three? Holy shit. One of us hasn't seen the original, and that is on the poll. And one of those four movies is going to win, and we're going to review it next week along with those other new releases. So thank you everybody for listening. We really appreciate you stopping by. Thank you very much for subscribing. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If you want to hang out and talk and stuff, you can always send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We're also on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @LynnBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
If you want a ton of exclusive shows on top of the shows that we have here at the Critically Acclaimed Network podcast feed, you can head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. In addition to voting for future episodes of shows, you get bonus shows about stuff like Batman, Star Trek, Disney, the Academy Awards, commentary tracks. We got a lot over there. There's a huge back catalog. So if you sign up for any tier, you're going to get a gigantic back catalog of stuff to search through. So thank you, everyone who's checking it out. Hope you're enjoying it. We have soap. Etsy.com. Look for Salt Cat Soap. You can also follow Salt Cat Soap on Instagram and Twitter. And that is a soap store run by myself and my wife and partner, M. Lampas da Silva. She is the soap crafter extraordinaire. Incredible designs, make wonderful gifts. Father's Day is coming up. We got a bit of a sale going on through the 31st on a few of our top tier items. So head on over there. We got soaps, lotions, bath salts, stickers, a lot of cool stuff. And Whitney has a couple of things he wants to tell you about too.
I'm on a new podcast that's not on this network. Over on the Screens Margins Network, a network founded by the venerable B. Peterson, they and I are doing a podcast all about Ovid, and it's called All About Ovid, spelled with all O's. Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Ovid is the streaming service for the deep cut art house stuff, all the stuff that played at like museums. And we're just sort of very casually going through Ovid and watching whatever we want to watch and just talking about it. It's very kind of loosely structured podcast, but we do get to talk about things on Ovid. So go on over to the Screens Margins. It's over there. Also, this is brand new. Mm-hmm. We have a post office box.
Yeah. We get some people every once in a while asking to send us like physical mail. Sometimes people send us like DVDs over the years. Not a lot, but it's happened. We wanted to make sure there was like one good address to give you for that. And now we have one.
So yeah, we have a post office box, so you can send your letters or packages to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565. Los Angeles, California, 90064. I'll say it again, P.O. Box 641565, LACA 90064. Do it today.
That was an MST3K reference. Pressure, though.
This is just radio voice reference, but yeah.
I remember Tom Servo saying it just like that. in any case, but yeah, no pressure, though. It's just we sometimes have people asking. Now we have one. So if you're inclined, that's the way to do that. Thank you very much to everybody. Yeah, I guess that's it. So thank you, everybody, very much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful day, night, week, whatever. Take a load off. You know, take off your socks. You know, just...
Take off your socks. You've been wearing them for weeks.
And never forget, everyone's a critic.